to Now, a series of podcasts where we celebrate all things related to the variously compiled world of pop. In the company of some wonderful guests, we open up gatefold vinyl sleeves, unfold cassette inlays, slip out CD booklets, and explore how our favourite compilation albums have shaped our lives and now fondly stand as time capsules for our own pop culture journeys. And join in with me, Ian, and the Back to Now social community by searching for the Pop Rambler pages. Joining me for this episode is writer, broadcaster and digital journalist Anna Dobble. Anna began her career as a newsreader and reporter in commercial radio in her home county of Yorkshire before moving to London to join Independent Radio News. She also ran the digital news team at Radio 1 and was head of online at Channel 4 News. Anna is currently digital editor at BBC World Service, where she leads on podcast, video and social media strategy and presents the show Pick of the World. A passionate music fan, Anna spent the year in lockdown listening to every single vinyl LP she ever bought in chronological order. And last but by no means least, Anna's book Connection is a Song, coming up and coming out through the music of the 90s, is published through 98 Books in May. Anna, welcome back to Now.
Ian, what an introduction. Did I really do those things? I feel like I'm a bit of, it doesn't sound like me at all. Sounds very tiring, but lovely to be here.
I'm going to jump straight to the book, and I'm going to quote a wee bit from this. In my room, surrounded by the toys of childhood, I found an escape tunnel. I begin to live in my own skin, daring to seek devotions I know exist but can't yet touch. I'm travelling through songs that seem to answer life's pressing questions. Who do you think you are? What time is love? Why does my heart feel so bad? Is there a better excerpt from any book for this podcast?
Well, there we go. I mean, the absolute power of music when you're young, especially, but always, to take you from, in my case, my loft bedroom in my house, my parents' house, they're still in that house, in North Yorkshire, and to transport you to places that you want to be, places that you imagine, and places that you kind of half know probably exist.
It's fabulous. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think because it sparked so many memories of that decade of the 90s, and I think so many shared memories that I know so many readers and listeners to this podcast will resonate with.
Absolutely. And do you know what? My friends have always kind of had a bit of a running joke that I'm always talking about the 90s. Of course, that gets funnier as the 90s recede from memory.
Yeah.
It was kind of a university joke that became, you know, a joke when I was, you know, kind of in various jobs and so on. And it's not as if I'm aware that some things in the 90s were not great in terms of music. And there was lots of, mainstream culture that in the book, of course, I am in a true teenage music snob way, a little bit sneering about. But I must say, as a sort of bookended era of my life, so I'm 11 at the beginning, 20 at the end, I was very lucky. I feel lucky, not just in music, but in what was going on in the wider world, benefiting from pretty much a free education at Leeds University. Sport was good, wasn't it? England did all right in a few tournaments, maybe 1990, maybe 96,
yeah.
In the football. So it was a sort of uplifting and optimistic time to be young. And, I can't be more grateful that that was the time that I was, I suppose, coming of age.
As you say, you've kind of interwoven family and friends and music and growing up, swapping Roy the Rovers for Smash Hits type yeah. thing as well. You know, that whole kind of period when pop music became the most important thing in their life.
Yeah, exactly that. And I was really into football, which was a hard thing to be. I love wandering around parks now and seeing girls kicking balls and it being absolutely standard to have girls' football teams in schools and things. But as you know from reading the book, I was basically stopped at 11, even though I was quite, you know, not amazing, but a decent-ish left winger. And I loved football and I lived and dreamed it. I collected the Panini stickers. All my friends at school and I would play at playtime. And then all of a sudden, secondary school is you're not playing. You play, you're a girl, you will play netball and hockey and then tennis, which I did love. But the Roy of the Rovers thing, it was, again, a bygone age of having a subscription to a magazine as a kid and going every week and hoping, because sometimes it was late and things, just hoping that it was there, ready for me, the comic was there, and then waiting for the shopkeeper to go through the pile, and there it was. All of a sudden, and a little bit through my sister who collected the Smash Hits stickers, remember the sticker albums?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just like, this is a sort of similar thing where you can collect things and sort of be part of something that, you know, is joined up in this huge universe of fandom, like football and pop music are very similar. The joy of music and the mood and the atmosphere that music creates I guess, like sport, it just suddenly gripped me and I started to buy my own Smash Hits. 52p, wasn't it, for a long time. And the free tapes you'd get on magazines led me to things, and then listening to my sister's music and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I kind of did, a little bit enforced by my secondary school not letting me play, I kind of did flip from football to pop music in kind of one day.
We're going to talk about 1994 quite a bit in this episode. As I was going through the book, I was writing down some of those albums and stuff that stood out for me in 1994. And one of them was His and Hers by Pulp.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't really truly know at the time what a gem it would be in retrospect. Yeah, no. Incredible album.
And as I was going through the book, the final track on that album, David's Last Summer, is for me one of, I think, one of Pulp's finest tracks, because it's Jarvis at his best. He's basically creating this kind of imagery of the kind of almost that kind of end of summer type feeling. And there were moments going through the book where you could almost, I could almost imagine the dust floating in the sun. Those kind of longing moments that teenagers often have about, you know, almost at the stage of something else, but not there yet.
I mean, there can be no higher praise than any comparison to David's Last Summer. You know, it's poetry, it's music, it's art. It sums up absolutely the feeling of, it's that thing that I do write about, but I think you've expressed, of being young and looking to your own future, but also feeling a weird nostalgia for things that maybe haven't even happened yet.
And
the feeling that when summer's end, everything changes, you know, that the September feeling is very familiar, I'm sure, to many listeners. I guess when you grow up, it sort of gets a bit less intense, but it is always with you, that feeling.
Yeah.
But yeah, I absolutely love that track. I first heard it from my sister's stereo. It's this track that never wears out. Its power is always there.
Coming up and coming out through the music of the 90s by Anna Dobell is published by 98 Books in May. Thoroughly recommended for anybody who has grown up with pop music. You will not be disappointed. We like to ask guests about growing up. Now, obviously, that's going to come through the book quite a wee bit. But you mentioned, and there was a wonderful line in the book about how music filled your house in layers.
Yeah, thank you for remembering that line. So, I mean, it's quite literal in some senses, because the house where I grew up is a terrace house, a Victorian house on the sort of side of a railway overlooking kind of part of the town where I live, which is kind of very sort of built on a crag. It's Knaresborough in North Yorkshire, if anybody knows it. So lots of height. So it felt quite high up, that house. And my room was in the loft. So beneath me was the middle layer. And so they felt like a kind of literal ownership of the sounds. So I was in the loft with my tapes and my pop music and the Radio 1 Road Show on the radio and things like that. My sister, older sister Claire, kind of owned the upstairs floor where her bedroom was, my parents' bedroom was. And she would have things on like All About Eve and quite kind of esoteric things that then became Britpop later on, but she had a really wide range of tastes, Claire, like really, and still does, really into Prince. So I heard a lot of Prince booming through the floorboards, and then she got really into Pulp. She's the biggest Pulp fan in the UK, I'm pretty sure. And then my dad owned the living room, so the ground floor.
Yeah.
He's a massive music fan. He owns a huge number of records and CDs as well. And loves, you know, really great American original rhythm and blues. He loves The Band. He loves Jerry Jeff Walker. He loves, who else? Joan Baez. He's from Liverpool, but he's not actually a huge Beatles fan, which is always entertaining. And then latterly, you know, we were growing up with Leonard Cohen, with Serge Gainsbourg. So, you know, really lucky to have really quality music around us. And to be fair, my mum had great music taste as well as when we were growing up, and still does. Yeah, lovely stuff like Simon and Garfunkel. So the ground floor had that kind of more 60s, 70s feel. Mm. The middle layer had Claire's music, and then the top layer that I shared with my little sister Kirsten was a bit more pop-tastic. Kyle and Jason definitely snuck in the roof. So in a literal sense, that's what I meant by layers, but I also mean that you learn about music through other music. So all of a sudden, I got into Nick Drake, kind of through my dad, and that led me to lots of other things that were, I suppose, connected to more modern music and indie that I was getting into as well. So guitar music, introspective, kind of mournful music, and So, yeah, the layers work in different ways.
You mentioned the book starting in 1990. Let's take a bit of time just to revisit Now 18 very briefly.
Now 18 brings you the massive number one from the Righteous Brothers. Now, that's what I call music.
You know, you talk about Sinead O'Connor, for example, in a book. Now 18 doesn't feature They Might Be Giants, unfortunately. But you
it
talk
should
about,
do, didn't she?
I know.
That's actually a real shocker in retrospect.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Birdhouse in Your Soul should
Birdhouse
be on there.
In Your Soul. But yeah, you had Now 18, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, so the main tape of my life really was Now 18, which I got for Christmas. And I can remember it vividly. I can remember unwrapping it, and it was, you know, that little deep cassette, double cassette shape.
Yeah.
I was like, yes, they got me it in blue lettering. Yeah, no, I absolutely played it to death. And that thing that many people on your podcast have talked about, which is where as one track ends, you hear the beginning of the next track and that never leaves you.
Yeah.
Even when you're hearing a song. If I hear, you know, certain songs on the radio, I'll start to hear the next track. So
yeah.
Now 18 is the one that I played to death. It's a real mad mix, isn't it? But it's got some real quality on it. And your episode with Lucy was absolutely fantastic. Songs like The Joker, Steve Miller Band, I think Lucy was a real fan of that. And I remember it too. And I don't know if I would have chosen that without Now guiding to me. It was obviously all over the radio at the time.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Tracks like that that just burned through all the kind of, I guess, more Stock Aitken and Waterman stuff I might have been actually listening to on my sort of neon cassettes. Do you remember the pink and yellow cassettes?
Yeah.
They were very dominant in my collection at that time.
Yeah. I think, you know, we often talk about those golden years, and it depends on how old you are. But 1990 seems to be a year that people often come back to. I don't know if it's just the genres, the variety, you know, there was a lot going on in 1990. Because you touched, for example, on bands like EMF and Cocteau Twins in the book as well. An album like Heaven or Las Vegas, for example, people will get very misty-eyed about in 1990.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to get misty-eyed. I mean, the thing about some of those albums is that you don't discover them till later. So I know that Heaven or Las Vegas was 1990, but I was not sophisticated enough at 11 to be
yeah.
near it. But I knew the name, I was intrigued by the name, and then later, even, you know, much, much later in the 90s and then into my 20s, 30s, they became a really key band for me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so the feeling, I think 1990 just, it was a crossover of things, wasn't it? Rave was sort of there still.
Yeah.
But had become commercial. So you had The Shame and people like that in the charts. And then you had a sort of new era coming in. Sort of shoegaze had given way to more accessible indie bands and
yeah.
kind of cute boys, EMF being one of them. And then, of course, big boy bands were coming in to be like Take That and then Boyzone later. So it was a great time, actually. And I guess the wider world was in flux as well. We'd had also Berlin Wall falling, Cold War ending,
yeah.
lots of big events in Europe. And somehow there was, again, a sort of mood of optimism that I think I didn't know I was picking up on as a kid, but I did, and I think music helps kind of paint the soundtrack to the world changing.
So we're going to look at Now 29, which was released at the end of 1994, and in some ways almost kind of bookends the kind of first, you know, the first half of the 90s really, really well. Why 1994 then? Why this period?
I think it's a great question because, for me, it's not all about Britpop, but if you had to, Ian, I'm going to challenge you now, if you had to pick a year that Britpop began or the Britpop phenomenon was born, which year would you pick?
Oh, right. OK, so would that be through received wisdom or what
you
we now know?
You can use all the wisdom
well,
that you
see,
need to answer this question.
For me, it would be 1993. I can remember the Stuart McConey Select. I can remember seeing Suede on the Brits. I can remember Modern Life is Rubbish sounding completely different. But that, for me, was also interwoven with so much more in 1993, pop music. But that was when Britpop was starting to... It stood out in the charts.
Yeah. Which I think is fair. And, of course, that famous front cover with Brett Anderson.
Yeah.
And the bands on that cover were The Auteurs, Denim, Saint Etienne, Suede...
Which
are not really Britpop.
Not Britpop, yeah.
Not bands you would go for. Suede, yes, but the others you wouldn't go to first.
Yeah.
In a quiz to say which bands synonymise Britpop. Yeah, for me, 94, I was 15. So I think there's a big difference between being 14 and 15 and then again 15 and 16. Not least because you can start going to gigs.
Yeah.
So I think for me, 94 was, and my sister, my older sister, who was very much in the book, Claire, she is in 94, I'm 15, so she is 18 going on 19. So through her, I was getting my head around this new scene. So for me, 94, obviously albums like Park Life, which we'll come back to, Definitely Maybe, the big boys of Britpop, and I hate to say that because lots of great female-led bands that I will definitely want to talk about and have done in the book. But the big, you know, the giants of Britpop were beginning to move, weren't they? And then actually, in true reality, my Britpop era properly began in terms of having the money to go and buy the albums was 95, which probably the likes of you, Ian, were too cool then, saying, oh, it's the scene's dead. But for me, that was almost the beginning.
But you're right.
Country house and everything.
Yeah, and that's why I mentioned earlier the received wisdom, because looking back, it's easy to say, oh, Britpop started with a copy of Select magazine. But you're right, it's probably 95, because by that point it had engulfed the world.
Yeah, and it was truly, truly commercial. And in terms of actually British music kind of conquering the world and everyone talking about it and it being in every TV show, by 95, you know, I can remember that summer, did my GCSEs. 95 was the year that, you know, even, you know, definitely my mum, but even my neighbours and my friends' mums knew who Jarvis Cocker was, knew who Damon Albarn was, knew who the Gallaghers were.
Yep.
Whereas 93, 94, it's still like an industry music kind of aficionado scene. But, you know, it's all great. It means we can remarket every year for the next few years, really, doesn't
exactly.
it? So we'll have to keep going.
Yeah. I mean, you know, 1995, by the time Chris Evans is running The Breakfast Show and he's got a dedicated jingle made for him by the Boo Radleys, you know that Britpop has eaten itself.
Absolutely.
And again, you know, we love the BBC to death, but how many times can they show the BBC News at 9 talking about Country House? versus
Peter
Roll with
Sissons
it. Again, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, because you know it's coming round.
The stock footage of someone in HMV, like, not
rifling
just buying
through
like
the CDs.
The tapes, but buying like the chord book. It's always like the Country House, the Blur chord book as well, which I did actually own because I did try and learn the chords, but. Yeah, no, but will I ever tire of that footage? I don't think I will. I do remember it at the time.
No, because it always brings something new to a story, you know, and we're always looking back from another year further away. So to me, there's always something interesting to find out about that period. That's why 1994 is probably very, very interesting, because it's like a kind of hinge year in so many ways.
Yeah, and there's some things on here as well that are... I guess the stars of yesteryear are still hanging in there.
Yes.
We'll come to it. But I guess that's the Now album's sort of magic trick, isn't it? That as a child listening, you learn about things that aren't really for you, like Rolling Stones are on there.
Yeah.
And that was like my dad's thing, and Louis Armstrong's on there. So, you know, I did learn a lot. And of course, the 90s were also a very fruitful time for reissues and re-releases.
Yeah.
So we moan now in 2024 about, oh, everything's been done before and the kids just hear stuff that's old, but that was happening, wasn't it, in the 90s too?
Yeah.
So
if a Now album is to do anything in 1994 or in 2024, it's to represent what is popular, and it does that.
Yeah, absolutely that.
So,
and it's funny because some of these tracks, I'm looking at my list, some of them I was like, oh, I don't know the title. And of course, when it began, I was like, of course I know this song. You know, absolutely, you can't, you know. So that's the other beauty of it.
Yeah.
In the mid-90s and in the halcyon days of the Now album, the tracks that are on there, it's pretty much unavoidable that you would have had to have been in a deep, dark forest to have not heard these songs in the world, on the radio, on TV shows, in the background. So,
As always... We've touched on it, the sequencing is fascinating.
Massively. You get little clusters of excellence or things that you just love, three in a row, and then almost you have to survive a trio that are just awful, and then but you know there's good times coming. And of course, the feeling of bothering to fast forward as a child or just letting it roll.
Yeah, exactly.
Going back to Now 18, you know, Bomb Ballerina's on there, isn't it?
Yes.
Am I right?
Yes.
So I can remember having to like... Do I bother to get up and fast forward? No, I'm doing my science homework. I'll just let it roll.
Now 29 with Michelle Gale. 38 top chart hits with the massive number ones from Wakefield. Take That and Pato Banter. The Real McCoy, Lisa Loeb, E17 and Corona. Now 29, that's what I call music. Oh, yeah.
Let's work our way through. As always with these albums, we will hover over some tracks longer than we may others. That's fine. It may be a democratic process of compiling, but it's not a democratic process of revisiting, is a phrase I might start using, actually. I quite like that one. But there we go. So, yeah, 38 top chart hits. Let's kick off then. I'm going to start with track one, which is Baby Come Back, which is Pat O'Banton with Robin and Ali Campbell.
And I do remember this vividly. I don't know when it was released within the year, but it reminds me of watching telly in the school holidays and a sort of uplifting feeling of the summer happening and having some time off. And that's my main association with it. It's a very, very cheerful, happy song, isn't it?
Yeah. So this was a November hit, but you're right, it's a very summery sound.
It's right.
Reggae was a big thing in the mid-90s. It's represented quite a bit on this album as well. You've got Robin and Ali Campbell from UB40 on there, so it's reggae royalty.
Yeah, it is. And it's a very infectious tune.
Mm.
And yeah, again, like you could not live in 94 and not have that song blasting at you at some point or other. I can't remember whether I ever danced to it. We must have done, wasn't it, at some point.
Probably.
But yeah, it's a happy song, isn't it?
Fourth biggest selling single of 1994.
Wow.
It was number one for 4 weeks, yeah. So track two is interesting. This is Cyndi Lauper. Hey Now, brackets, Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
Is it a slower version? Because I do remember at the time being kind of like, oh, Cyndi Lauper, she's back.
Yeah.
Was this a remix?
So it was a new version of it that she'd done. It was added to her first Best Of album and then put out as a single to promote the Best Of.
I mean, it's obviously a great tune and we all love Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah.
But it just feels a bit slow, doesn't it? Compared to the actual Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
Yeah.
But I do remember thinking that at the time and it being on in sort of nights out and stuff when I would have started to go to local town nightclubs. I do remember it.
Because we've obviously talked about 94 as being the Britpop beginnings and things. It takes a while to feature on this album, shall we say.
It truly, truly does.
It does take a while before we get
there. But that's how it felt. And this is where sometimes when I read, when I've read back chapters from my book, I sometimes have a little moment of, maybe the 90s weren't that kind of, you know, in my memory, Supergrass and Pulp and, Blur were in the top 10. But in reality, it was these kinds of tracks that dominated that were on commercial radio and so on.
And that's why revisiting these albums are great. And actually, to get a real snapshot of what 1994 was like, you have to go back to these. And that continues into track three, which is Big Mountain and Baby, I Love Your Way.
Well, this is definitely one where I initially thought, oh, I don't know this. But of course I know this.
Yeah.
I mean, do we sing on this podcast?
We can do that.
I mean, Big Mountain, absolutely zero memory of that name.
No.
And to read the name, you'd think they were like a country outfit or something, wouldn't you?
Big
Mountain. They should be driving a truck through a forest.
Yeah.
But no. Yeah. So, ooh, baby, I love your way. Yeah, that's the track we're speaking of.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
It's absolute. It's a fantastic, like, happy club banger, isn't it? That gets everyone on the dance floor. So I've now sung on track three. It can only go downhill from here. But I was like, oh, of course. So I really enjoyed hearing that again and being reminded that that again is what the 90s actually sounded like.
It was a huge hit. Number two, this was from the Reality Bites soundtrack. And if you want a 1994 film, Reality Bites is one of those films. Because that was that Ethan Hawke and Winona Ryder. So importantly, okay, so we're at our first boy band. We're at Take That and Sure. This was the fifth of their eight number ones, and it was lead single from album number three, which was, of course, Nobody Else. You touch a wee bit on Take That in the book.
I do. So the song in the book is Once You've Tasted Love, which I loved, and it had a sort of, on Take That and Party, of course, it had a more, I don't know, more grown-up clubby feel to it. I did really get into Take That, and most notably because I had this TT stencil that came free with the Promises cassette. But this track, Sure, I had to go and look it up, and I'm amazed it was a lead single because it shouldn't be a lead single, should it? It should be like the fifth single. It's not good enough for a lead single, is it?
It's not. But it shows you where Take That were by 1994, that this burst to the top of the charts. It's not very memorable, is it?
Well, first of all, the kind of opening keyboards do sound like, you know, when you're a kid meddling around with like the fill-in button and stuff on your Casio keyboard or in the music blog.
Yeah.
It sort of sounds deliberately quite sort of thin. But then I thought, is it one of the sort of Gary Barlow offcuts that he just found on the tape in his bedroom? But I think it was written jointly, wasn't it? I think Robbie and Mark wrote it with him. So it probably was a really true take that tune in that they actually did put it all together in their time as a huge, huge, you know, boy band with a massive fan base. So to be fair, it is, you know, a proper take that song, but it's just very two-dimensional, isn't it?
Sorry, take that, fans.
Still buy my book. Yeah. And it does have a lot of praise for Once You've Tasted Love, but not this song.
That was really well done. I would go back to the early stuff. I mean, that would take, it only takes a minute or something like that. And
yeah, I mean, they're all absolutely the kind of tunes you want to come on when you're on the waltzes in a fairground.
You wouldn't want Shure to come on if you're on the waltzers.
No, you wouldn't.
No, you'd be asking for your money back.
But there we go.
Where are we next? Michelle Gale. Sweetness.
And the first track on this album that I absolutely love and have absolutely zero guilty pleasureness. It's a brilliant little song.
It's really nice.
This is summer holiday listening, actually, truly.
Yeah.
It's a lovely little song. What was it? Was she Hattie in EastEnders?
She was Hattie, yeah.
Yeah. So I could just remember the feeling of, oh, look, that girl off EastEnders is a pop star.
Yeah.
And it's just a really enjoyable song, and even now, and it doesn't really come on the radio now, does it? But when it comes on Spotify or whatever, I just thoroughly enjoy it. It's a really well-crafted pop tune. Do you know what number it got to?
It got to number 4. So
yeah, like all the good stuff, top 5, but not actually number 1.
Yeah, that's it. That's the cooler position to be, I would say, to be honest, number 4. Okay, banger. Track 6, Saturday Night, Wakefield.
You've just said banger. My only notes... I've written Wigfield, towny banger.
Yeah, it is.
And it is absolutely the soundtrack of my first forays into going out to nightclubs. So just about squeezing in, probably a bit later than its release date because I did look really young in my mid-teens. In my hometown of Knaresborough, there was a club called Night Out, which in the book... It's called...
Shite Out. Yeah.
And that's what it was locally known as. I'm sorry to anyone listening who ran that club, because we'd actually had a really fun time in there. But you could not get a more perfect track for Shite Out than Wigfield Saturday Night. It summed it all up. You were there, you'd spent your tenner on, in my case, at Pernod and Lemonade.
Yeah.
You were feeling a little bit sick, but you were going to dance through it. And on comes... and you're on the dance floor with all your friends, and it is a moment. And for that alone, we cannot deny the power of Wigfield.
No. I mean, that is as plastic a perfect pop track as you can want. But it somehow sits alongside Britpop. It sits alongside that kind of heady mix of what the 90s were all about.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I actually think the bands that were the most smart in the era of Britpop probably Suede. Probably, we've talked about Saint Etienne and we will again.
Yes.
But so someone like Brett Anderson, I'm sure, in his own way, really appreciated his music being in amongst the Wigfields. His lyrics about, you know, provincial towns and litter on the breeze, and it completely is, he is describing this world of, like, nightclubs where Wigfield is blasting out. And somebody's puked in the corner. Someone else is... You know, the clubs I went to in the mid-90s had, like, you could buy a chip butty, like, inside the club, like, during the night, and then return to the dance floor. You could buy fast food. It is Britpop.
Well, this isn't the superstar DJ culture of the end of the 90s. This is the provincial nightclub sound of a Saturday night, which Jarvis was writing about at the same time. So it's, you know, if you think about... pop as a culture, as a moment in time, tracks like that are the ones that stay with us and are kind of interwoven into what the fabric of the 90s were. I'm sounding very serious. I think I may have to pull this back. But
No, you're not, but your mentioning of Jarvis is right. Jarvis Cocker was an outsider to this world, and himself sort of feeling like, kind of he might get beaten up on the way home, or, you know, he was sort of not part of mainstream sort of lads going out with their shirts untucked kind of society. But Brett Anderson, Jarvis Cocker and Damon Albarn, by pointing out the sort of towny culture, they were almost sort of making it part of their music in a sense too. You know, Girls and Boys, obviously, is a track all about kind of people probably puking on dance floors. I keep referring to this. Wigfield, you know, you cannot get more of a big mainstream tune, and I presume it was number one for a while.
This was the track that knocked Wet 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 off number one, so we wave a flag to that straight away.
Yeah, so what, Love Is All Around?
Love Is All Around had been number one for 15 weeks, and this knocked it off.
She'd done some public service there.
So we're happy. We're happy for Sani Carlson, because let's give her a name. Yeah. 4 weeks. It was the second biggest selling single of 1994 after Wet Wet Wet. So, you know, we know what we like in this country.
We do. Yeah. We buy it in droves. Right.
So, now, actually, let's take track 7 and 8 together, because if we're still in that nightclub, then we're probably going to be dancing around to Another Night by MC Sar and the Real McCoy and The Rhythm of the Night by Corona, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yes, we are. We are still in the nightclub, aren't we? Yeah. I like them both, actually. They're they're really honest, proper dance tunes. Handbag House, I guess. Like everybody dancing around. I probably would pick Corona, Rhythm of the Night, as the better one there. It's an absolute tune, actually. Probably, I don't know, I wasn't going to Ibiza in 94, sadly.
No.
But I guess it would have been a big Ibiza tune that year as well. Don't get me singing again, but it is, it's a really, really infectious chorus, isn't it?
You can't two
really,
songs sung on the first side. Calm, calm. We'll get it. But I'm going to quote you back here again, Anna, in the book. You talk about the Fairground Rush sounds the way Lemon Hooch tastes. Would that be something along the lines of Corona, perhaps?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. A sweet sugar rush, refreshing briefly, but possibly doesn't kind of an emptiness to follow. But yeah. I don't know. I think it's a really great pop tune. I would never sort of say anything negative about it. I'd love to hear it if I was on a night out now. It would be a really fun moment.
When Bob Stanley was on, another mention of Sinetian, when Bob Stanley was on, he talked very, very passionately about that mid-90s Europop thing and how when he was actually wanting to get all the single edits of tracks like this, he went and bought the Now album because they were all there, and it saved buying £4 CD singles for one mix that you only wanted. Alexis Petridis had mentioned this as well, not on my podcast, but he'd mentioned it in an article in The Guardian, just about that kind of anticipatory excitement of the night out. That's the British nightclub culture that we like so much.
Yeah. And the DJ is playing it. You may have played it, and absolute certainty that you would fill the dance floor if you put Corona on.
Yeah.
And I think I mentioned it in the chapter in my book where I'm talking about another club I went to in my teens called Jimmy's in Harrogate, and it was sort of harder to get in because you actually had to look the right age. But I remember going there in sort of lower sixth, and Corona for sure, and then Strike You Sure Do fits in with this. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, yeah.
And there were sort of, even though I was really trying hard to be like an indie music snob, why don't they ever play, the bands I like? I actually loved those songs and really enjoyed them when they came on. And in a sense, because I didn't buy them as much as like the indie albums, the indie tracks, they're more of a time capsule now. To hear it again, it takes me back more because I haven't sort of overplayed it or hasn't soundtracked any other part of my life. So, they're great.
Yeah, but that's a lovely sequence on that side there of those three tracks.
It is a good little run. Yeah. We're going to get punished for this, Ian. It can't go on like this.
No, it can't, sadly. Right, well, okay, next. Interesting. Right, so True Faith 94, New Order. Of interest here that it was re-released by London Records, not Factory Records, because this was when New Order had shifted and Factory was kind of gone. So this was the beginning of that reissue package time for New Order.
And because you're a bit older than me, you noticed this, but of course I'm how old am I here? 15. Yeah. So I'm kind of just thinking, this is a great New Order track, and not realizing it's kind of a comeback for that song, for True Faith.
Yeah.
But talking of little trios, I mean, we are in a sort of the best spell of the album here, because actually I'm looking ahead. New Order, a band that I absolutely adored a bit later than this. Mm. I would have heard this for sure. And I would have associated them, of course, with Italia 90 and World in Motion, because I was massively into football when I was younger. The thing that I really remember New Order the most for in my life is putting on their greatest hits, which obviously had this on it, and going on like circular bus rides around Leeds when I was in my student years, and just listening to them like on a loop as I just, for no apparent reason, went round and round Leeds on a bus just to, so I could look out the window and pretend I was in a pop video like we all do. So I associate True Faith and I guess, Bizarre Love Triangle, all the big ones with that time. But yeah, I mean, there it is, nestled between Corona and
Sophie B. Hawkins.
Yes, which is an absolutely fantastic pop song. Yeah, I love it.
This is a track you never hear anymore. I can't imagine this being programmed by a radio station.
It's a shame because it's such an easy radio hit. So Right Beside You is the track we're speaking of.
It's brilliant.
It's so, like, what, Radio 2, have a word with yourselves, get it on. It's great.
Her other big hit was Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
This track actually got one place higher on the charts, but you're probably more likely to hear Damn than you are this. So Radio 2...
Because it has a novelty title, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover. I tell you where I have heard this and been delighted to hear it, and this is a bit London-centric, so forgive me if you're listening outside London, but the wonderful Ducky, the night that Mark and Jelly used to be the Reader's Wives, I've heard them play this, and it absolutely filled the dance floor. So everybody is like us, secretly wanting this back in their ears. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that Mark will be listening to this, and he will be now cheering.
Mark,
in his seat.
I have danced to this when you've hit play and I've loved it, and we want you back.
7 Seconds, Youssou N'Dour featuring Nina Cherry, the only trilingual track to make the UK charts.
Oh, what are the three lingual? I can get two, I think. What's the third?
French and English, and at the risk of pronouncing it wrong, Wolof. This was number one in France for 16 weeks, one more than Wet, Wet, Wet in this country, and probably much better
good work.
As well.
I love this song, by the way. I had it on Kasingle.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, no, you're right, actually. There's a... It must be the African language. How do I say it again? Wolof.
Wolof. W-O-L-O-F. And apologies to any listeners who are now shouting at us for that.
Absolutely. Correct us, please. Like I say, I went and bought the cassette and I really loved this song. I think it's got a really amazing structure. It's like a really unusual song. It's not a normal pop song. It's really moving. A very sort of beautiful kind of...
Yeah.
It's a wonderful song, and I'm going to ask you what number it got to.
Well, I'm going to say...
I hope it was high.
Well done, UK Buying Public, number 3.
That's pretty decent, actually. Well done, Brits. Yep.
Next to that is something I've written in brackets, very 1994. Lisa Loeb and Nine Stories, Stay I Missed You.
See, this is why I think we're in the best run on the album here, because I sound like I like everything. And believe you me, there are things we're going to come to that I don't like. But this is a fantastic single. And it made me remember there were loads of great female vocalists in the 90s. It all got washed away a bit by all the blokes with guitars and stuff, but she's got a gorgeous voice. When I worked in commercial radio later on, so into the 2000s, this was on all the time, and I always enjoyed it.
Would you like a good story about this one? This was in the Reality Bites soundtrack. Lisa Loeb's neighbour was Ethan Hawke. Heard her singing it, allegedly, in her flat. Knocked on her door, said, "I want that song for the film." Went to Ben Stiller, who was the director. Bingo.
Oh, wow. It's a great story. I'm glad that happened.
First artist to top the Billboard chart as an unsigned artist. So,
which was signed as a result of this song, then, I presume.
Yep, and that then gave her a career. So, well done, Lisa Loeb.
Yeah, well done, Lisa Loeb.
Next up, you've got Crash Test Dummies. It is just isn't it?
It's better than I remember, though. When it was coming up, I thought, oh, not sure about that. But it's a fun listen, actually.
I kind of dug up some old reviews and stuff like that, and NME called it an oddity. A melodic saunter. The softer side of REM. It's that kind of... But it's all a bit pretentious, actually. It's just a nice song.
But it's got a bit of depth to it as well. It could be on... Yeah. Was it on a film? It sounds like it could be on a film soundtrack.
I don't know. I don't think Ethan Hawke was in when they were singing that.
No, sadly not. So Lisa Loeb cornered that one.
Trying, you know. But it could... And it got to number 2. Kept off number 1 by Prince, so fair enough. It's nice and it kind of flows. Robert Palmer. No, it's not Robert Palmer next. I'll try that again.
Louis Armstrong first.
It's Louis Armstrong next.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a song that was around forever before this. We Have All the Time in the World. You can't argue with it. It's a brilliant song.
No.
My dad would often come in when Top of the Pops was on and say, "Why is this on?" And same with, like, Benny King and Percy Sledge and, you know, things that just... And obviously the Righteous Brothers were big in the 90s. He would sort of complain a bit that, "Why are they on now? These aren't..." And then sort of just stay because he actually liked them.
Yeah,
so, and we would just be like, "Oh, I don't know, Dad. It's just like some old guy that's like been on a film and it's a good song though, isn't it? So, like, let's not complain. Let's just let it roll." But obviously a timeless classic, isn't it?
And now we're always great at making sure those tracks feature. they must have almost have loved it at EMI and Virgin Records when a track like this got reissued. And this was back out, I think it was, this was Guinness had put it in an advert. And they must have thought, brilliant, we can get a classic like We Have All the Time in the World on a Now album as well.
Yeah, so sort of advertising in the 90s was what TikTok is doing now, like resurfacing old classics or things that didn't have a sort of fair hearing the first time. But we, I don't think we can say that about Louis. It seems fairly well known before 94.
Yeah, this didn't chart in 1969.
Oh, that's absolutely mad. Absolutely bonkers.
Whereas this time round, number three, you know?
Yeah, it's so strange. I guess that says a lot about how the charts actually operated back in the 60s and then in the 90s. Yeah, that's mad. Yeah.
There is out there a My Bloody Valentine cover of this. They did it for a charity record for Northern Ireland in 1993.
Wow, why don't we know about this?
Because it was on a kind of random compilation album in the 90s, I don't think, and it's not on streaming. I automatically went and checked, couldn't find it. So you'd have to go and dig it out, probably from a charity shop or something or whatever.
And I hope that they play the Chord of Doom in the middle eight. It just goes on for 20 minutes of white noise.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's actually a whole side of an album. So thanks, Kevin.
Cool.
Now we can talk about Robert Palmer. This was his last top 30 hit.
This is the first track I encountered on Now 29 that I was like, no, can't remember. I have to confess, I just don't know this song particularly. I must have heard it on the radio. I obviously remember Robert Palmer, but am I meant to recognise it?
It kind of drifts along quite pleasantly. UK Buying Public responded correctly, number 25.
That's why then, isn't it? I just don't remember it. Robert Palmer was one of those artists who, as a child, you always thought was old.
Yeah.
Like, you assumed was a middle-aged man because he was in a suit as well.
Yeah.
And very well turned out. But then now, when you see him on Top of the Pops 2, you know, reruns, you're like, oh, he's 34.
Yeah, I know.
in that moment, he's a young man. And but we just viewed him as an older guy.
Yeah.
I know.
What's the frequency, Kenneth?
Fantastic tune, and lucky us getting it on a Now album.
I know. Ninth album, Monster. This is the album that people often overlook in REM's canon. And it's actually really worth a revisit. Brilliant. And that was obviously the opening track for that album as well.
Do you know the Kenneth story? I don't think I know it. Who is Kenneth? Remind me.
Luckily, I do, funnily enough.
And it's again, like we planned this.
It's like we planned it. So the song's title refers to an incident in New York in 1986 in which two then-unknown assailants attacked a journalist called Dan Rather while repeating, Kenneth, what's the frequency?
Well, now, I'm sure this is a really well-known story to true REM fans, but I did not know that.
But
I think for me at the time, REM felt too grown up for me. I sort of knew they were good.
Yeah.
But they were like, they were for the grown-ups, and I was still in my mid-teens and sort of didn't think that I was allowed to like them, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Obviously, we're going to talk the kind of the emerging Britpop that's coming through in 1994. I always think it's interesting to kind of compare what America sounded like at the same time. We didn't lock the door in America in 1994, 95, but things were shifting a bit.
And I guess there's a hint with REM of, we were talking about They Might Be Giants earlier, with that sort of more lyrical cleverness rather than grunge, which was just very emotional sort of slabs of music that were kind of, there wasn't much nuance in it. And obviously it's, some of it's amazing, but whereas this had that kind of wit to it as well. Therefore, there is a parallel with Britpop. To look back on that time now, there was a real, culturally, there was a real encouragement to kind of take sides. I'm a Brit and I like British music and the Americans can go home. It's like, well, no, it's both things are good and they, you know, accompany one another.
Yeah.
I mean, famously, REM and Blur played Milton Keynes Bowl, didn't they, around this
time?
Right.
Yeah.
So lucky, lucky people that got to watch both bands in the same night.
Next, Oasis.
Doesn't
ring any bells.
In the 90s. Yeah, we probably should move on.
This was Oasis' first appearance on a Now album, so that's notable. Where does Cigarettes and Alcohol sit now in Oasis canon?
My favourite Oasis album, the single is probably Live Forever.
Yeah.
It's like a beautiful kind of, it's got everything in it. It's nostalgic, it's future looking, it's confident, it's a bit brash, it's cocky, all the things you want from a 90s single. Cigarettes and Alcohol, it's not as good, but I think it's, you know, probably looking back on Oasis, and I very much was on the Blur side of the fence, but it's a proper Oasis tune, isn't it?
Yeah.
When it kicks in, it has what, you know, it has that sort of status quo-y simplicity.
Yeah.
The first bars open. It's just that swaggering sound that we now know was the sound of the mid-90s. I have a slightly odd story about this song. Because I was a real Blur fan and I'd invested like my pocket money in the Blur albums and the Blur singles, didn't really have enough money to then also be an Oasis fan. And I tried to kind of be on, you know, the battle at school. I would be on the side of Blur. But I also did want to hear it. I wanted to hear what everybody was talking about and hear the album tracks as well as the singles. So I found it on my hometown market for £3, which, of course, even in the 90s, was quite cheap. So I just bought this tape of Definitely Maybe, and then when I got it home, started playing it. It was all good. It wasn't like a bootleg. Got to Cigarettes and Alcohol. I noticed that even though the song was the same, he was singing and alcohol, the title on the track listing was just Cigarettes. I was like, hang on a minute. That song's not called that. Looked in the small print on the cassette inlay, and it said, for sale only in GCC countries, like Gulf countries. So basically countries where alcohol is not encouraged as it is in a North Yorkshire market town. So, so they'd had to sort of redact the word alcohol from the track list. But obviously not the song because they couldn't bleep.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so I have this really weird copy of Definitely Maybe that's got a sort of weird track listing. Yeah. If anyone wants to buy it off me...
I was just thinking that there's probably people listening to this going, I need that copy in my life. Yeah.
So. I mean, I played it to death in my bedroom, so it won't be in mint condition, but it's definitely like an Oasis curiosity for anyone who's interested in that sort of stuff. But
Wow.
So in Gulf countries, the track was called Cigarettes.
Rolling Stones, Love is Strong.
I didn't really realise at the time that they were doing new things in the 90s. I didn't notice them doing new things. It's quite nice hearing this in amongst all the sort of more contemporary, sort of youthful things that we were loving. I mean, can't argue with the Rolling Stones, really, can you?
No, not really.
They deserve to be on a Now album, don't they, generally? Yeah. Do they feature like 10 times on Now albums? I mean, I presume they're on...
No, no.
They don't.
This was their second appearance on a Now album to this point. They'd been on Now 2... with a song called Undercover of the Night. And actually, they were on the last Now album, Now 116.
So have any of their actual big tunes been on a Now album?
No, because they're all still alive. Well, actually, no, they're not. Actually, they are now starting to die, aren't they? But I think Now, that sounds terribly morbid, to get on a Now
was
album...
Was that the criteria in it? I missed that memo.
I'm not saying that's official Sony Music criteria, but I think to get a big track on Now, there may have... Or, again, TikTok or... Netflix or something would have to happen to get Jumpin' Jack Flash or Sympathy for the Devil back onto a Now album. But there we are. So number 14.
Right.
Probably about
well
right.
Well done, Rolling Stones. Well done, Mick.
So, and also number 14 was the last track on this CD, which is Zombie by the Cranberries.
This is absolutely emblematic of that time, wasn't it? It was everywhere, this song. And it's a great, great tune and so unique, really, in its lyrics and the structure and... Mm. I think I like it more now than I did at the time. I think I was a bit spoiled at the time and sort of just assumed that songs of this quality roll around the charts often, but it's great, isn't it? And I presume it will have a comeback of some sort on the programme now, or may already have had one, but I feel like it's been on trailers and things for TV shows. Yeah. But yeah, I love it. Absolutely love it.
So.
Zombie's not their biggest tune. What was the one that got to the...
Would that be Linger?
Yes, you're so right. It is Linger. Yeah, and it cut through, didn't it? It's just not the same as all the other pop rolling around. And I think, like I say, I appreciate it more now than at the time, but just an amazing vocal.
Yeah.
It really just makes you stop and listen, actually.
And a big track to finish the first CD with as well.
Yeah, good choice.
Next on Top of the Pops, E17, all around the world, right out front.
Let's move across then onto Compact Disc 2, or Cassette 2, if you're flipping over, taking out the cassette, put the next one in. And we've had Take That already, so let's go to... Well, we have to go to E17 and Around the World, who also got mentioned in the book, don't they?
I'm actually glad that they're both on this album, actually. That feels fair.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think so.
It's Around the World, brackets Our World. And I don't massively recall it. It just doesn't have enough of a hook for me. I would have been buying smash hits at this time. I would have seen them everywhere. Their little dog icon was on things, wasn't it? And Brian Harvey and, yeah, the kind of bad boys of pop, the, yeah, the sort of the inverse of Take That. And in the track I do love by E17, I quite like a few of them, actually, but the one I really love is Deep. I think that's the single that... And I talk about it when I've been writing about the time my friend in her bedroom recorded Deep, like looped it again and again and again and again on a cassette on both sides, so that we could, because in the old days, children, you couldn't just loop it on Spotify. You had to do some work and craft it yourself to make it loop. So yeah, we had that playing like again and again and again as we would talk about boys and stuff and try to sneakily smoke cigarettes out of her window. So I love Deep. This one, however, it just, I don't really remember it as much.
On the day this album was released, now 29, Stay Another Day was also released as a single. So that was the single before that. So by the time this album was in stockings for Christmas, Stay Another Day was number one. So I think it gets slightly overshadowed.
I mean, a little bit of an understatement.
Being quite nice there, wasn't I?
I mean, I'm pleased because Stay, obviously, is like one of the most enjoyable Christmas songs and always will be.
Yeah,
but yeah. So they got they made their money elsewhere.
Yes, I think so. I don't know if we're going to move slightly quickly over the next few tracks.
I think we may have to. But then, Compliments on Your Kiss. You know, one of those sort of earwormy wedding disco-y tunes.
Yeah, I mean, it got to number two. So again, it proves we like a good reggae number in this country.
Yeah, and the lyric is sort of one of those ones you sort of now and again. Sort of people say it, like, your number one girl on my list is sort of memorable.
Exactly.
A bit like when anyone ever gets a key out, someone says, I've got the key, I've got the secret. I mean, it's just that's what we people from the 90s do.
It is what we do. So, and we've also got on there Chakademus and Pliers, Gal Wine.
Yeah, again, Chakademus and Pliers, just for the weirdness of their name. I sort of really remember them.
Yeah.
I think, again, my dad would have come in the living room and gone, what, Pliers?
Like, yeah.
The band of the Pliers.
Can't call somebody Pliers?
Yeah,
I know.
It's not quite the Supremes, is it? But but yeah, it kind of it very much evokes the 90s, this little run, and how it actually sounded.
R. Kelly, we're not going to talk about.
She's got that vibe.
Yeah. Mm. Next up, Midnight at the Oasis by Brand New Heavies.
Which I love, actually. I love this song.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, that's...
I mean, who doesn't want to send their camel to bed?
As I am always chasing my camel to bed.
And again, I mean, there are other Brand New heavy songs that I like more, but this one was up everywhere, wasn't it, that year?
Yeah, yeah.
What number did it get to?
This got to number 13.
All right, so...
What's next? Stars by China Black.
This is slightly heading into the Robert Palmer area of I can't fully remember at the time.
No, it was the follow-up to Searching, which was a bigger track.
Searching was huge, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah. When I listened back to this, it was almost looking forward to that, and I say looking forward in inverted commas, to the Lighthouse Family and that kind of smooth, kind of late 90s, slightly territory of that, you know. Mm. It's not bad, but it's pretty
kind of music to listen to, sort of show how good car stereos are, weren't they, those kinds of songs?
Yes. Yeah, I would imagine so. Right, so here is a track, which is a cover of the Marvin Gaye song, What's Going On. It was a charity record by Music Relief.
So it was a sort of attempt at Band-Aid.
It was a charity single that was released for the Rwandan fundraisers. On this record were C.G. Lewis, Rochford, Yaz, Aswad, Edwin Starr, Peter Cooner from D-Ream, Kim Appleby, Mick Jones, Rosala, Tony DeBart, Paul Young, Paul Carrick, Jimmy Ruffin, Omar, Nick Kershaw, Mark King from Level 42, Jules Holland, Danny Minogue and Larry Adler. We're all on this track, and it got to number 70.
Okay, oh my God, 7-0. Oh my goodness. So it flopped as a fundraiser, sadly.
Yeah.
It's got some brilliant people on there.
It's
and
huge.
You can't go wrong with a Marvin Gaye cover.
No.
Really? But maybe they did. I don't know. Weird. It clearly wasn't, we don't remember it. I'm in my mid teens, you're in your early 20s. It didn't catch us anywhere.
No recollection of this
weird
whatsoever.
Weird marketing. Presumably, Top of the Pops would have played the video or something, wouldn't they?
I would hope so. There'll be people
so
out there who'll know, but it's just like, oh. But let's rescue the situation with Celine Dion.
Words I utter often.
I had to just remind myself, this of course is The Power of Love, which is actually Jennifer Rush, right?
Sadly, not Huey Lewis's version, which would have been pretty good.
Okay.
But this is.
And was it in a... Am I being thick? Was it in a film this year?
No.
So it's not even for that reason. Okay, because I thought, could it have been in a big Tom Cruise film or something? So, look, it's Celine Dion. She can sing. She's got some pipes on her. And it's a beautiful, epic power ballad, isn't it? But did we need Celine to cover it? I'm not sure we did.
No, we didn't. This was her first solo top 10 hit in this country. So this is where it all begins for Celine. Sadly.
But that's really interesting then.
Yeah.
This is the gateway drug.
This is the gateway. It wasn't Think Twice. It wasn't Titanic. It was this. This got to number 4. Kickstarted it all, and
I am pouring a drink here, which is incredibly audible, it would seem. But you know, Celine, you've made me reach for my beer.
She has that effect, I believe. So there we go. I didn't listen to all of it, I'm going to be honest.
No,
I listened to the up to the chorus and before she lets the pipes take off, and I thought, you're all right, Celine. I know, I've seen this film, I know how it goes. Particularly when you've got, I think, one of Kylie's best tracks next.
Yes, I'm so happy we agree. She totally rescues the situation, so Confide in Me is a tune.
Damn you, Wet, Wet, Wet. You stopped this from getting to number one in your 65-year run with Love Is All Around. I mean, any other week of any other year, this would have been one of Kylie's big number one moments. Yeah.
But what a wonderful song. And I think, again, it sounds really fresh. It doesn't sound...
No.
Old at all. And I think by this point I was becoming a music snob, so I'd have been like, oh, not Kylie. But it's brilliant. And I'm trying to place it in her sort of the Kylie timeline. Is she hung out with Nick Cave yet?
She's on the way. He's in the foyer waiting for her downstairs.
He's in reception.
This is Kylie having left Stock Aitken & Waterman and PWL a couple of years earlier and then signing for Deconstruction Records. Very cool 90s dance record.
Mm-hmm.
Brothers in Rhythm, production, remixing, all that kind of stuff. New image, that wonderful cover with the glasses on and the suit, and she just looks amazing.
It is a beautiful song. Do we know who wrote it? Because it sort of feels really different to everything else that's gone before.
So I think it was the Brothers in Rhythm production team that had written it with her as well. Just wonderful feel to it.
Yeah, it's kind a haunting sort of song, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's got a darkness to it, but it's very, very beautiful. And it sort of showcases what a great singer she is as well, because we think of her as like showbiz and pure pop, but actually she's got a really beautiful voice, and this track showcases it.
I haven't mentioned Sinetian for at least 15 minutes, so let's mention Sinetian.
We've done quite well, haven't we?
There's more coming, listeners, don't worry, they're always... Kylie covered Nothing Can Stop Us on the CD single.
And of course, Nothing Can Stop Us is actually sampling Dusty Springfield.
Yes.
So you have this actually multi-layered trio of excellence there, don't we? I couldn't want a nice little flush in cards of good things in a row.
I have nothing to pour myself a drink, but that deserves a drink poured moment, doesn't it? Dusty, Sinetian, Kylie. Yeah. Oh, it's just perfect. So, Massive Attack, Sly.
Massive Attack. Yeah. I don't want to give the end of my book away or bore anybody with any further references to that. But Massive Attack, not this track, pinnacle of my 90s, actually, in that they're a band that began their excellent things at the very beginning of the 90s and sort of almost stealth-like. When you watch early episodes of 90s Top of the Pops,
yeah,
a Massive Attack, come on, they're so much better than everything around them.
Yeah.
They just sound big, they've got a gravitas to them. Mm. Massive Attack, I didn't really truly engage with until the very end of the 90s when I was at university, so 98, 99. People would listen to like Blue Lines all the time. And it wasn't really till then that I noticed or fully engaged with how amazing their sound is. But then Sly is kind of a little bit off the beaten track, but it's got that lovely, brooding...
Oh yeah,
timing, sort of gorgeousness to it, and you can't go wrong with it, really.
Well, we're on to the last side, and I think we need to hold our breath for moments
do.
On this
we
side.
Do.
It starts off with Eternal, so good.
Yeah, and so I really like, you know, Eternal really remind me of being, actually, funnily enough, a bit later in sixth form, and my sort of female group of friends loved Eternal and sort of almost sort of wanted to look like them and dress like them, and that and All Saints was sort of the vibe. But this particular track, So Good, is sort of not quite the one that I would sort of turn to, but I do love Eternal, and they are... There are, again, when we hark back to the 90s and we talk about all the male bands, the Blurs and the Oasises, it's actually the real feel of the 90s was bands like Eternal everywhere, like their poster in the record shop window in Woolworths and stuff. It wasn't actually Liam Gallagher in your face all the time. It was this kind of music. So I'm quite pleased to be reminded of that.
And number 13. It's hugely much better than the track that comes next, which is called Some Girls by Ultimate Chaos. Do you know who we've got to blame for this?
Go on.
Simon Cowell.
Oh, have we?
Yeah.
Oh, dearie me. I mean, I have written in my extensive notes, worst track on the album? Question mark.
Yeah, I'll give you that. This was the first of their six top 52 hits.
Top 52, that well-known metric.
They were Sunita's backing dancers. He supported Take That in 1994.
Yeah. So sort of like the mini boy bands that sort of came on the coattails of the big boy bands.
The follow-up was called Hoochie Booty. Well, I'm not even going to go there.
Oh, I do remember that.
Do you?
Cause it was such a weird title.
God, you're better than me.
But I feel like that one did better than this, but I may be wrong.
Whilst we're in the hinterland of hinterlandness, shall we have Reel to Reel featuring the Mad Stuntman and Can You Feel It?
Yes, we should.
Yes.
I think I've just... My notes have got even more brief.
Yeah, if anybody was to ask what their favourite reel-to-reel is going to be, I Like to Move It, and then, that's it. There we go.
That's the only one we need, isn't it?
Incredible by MBeat featuring General Levy is of note. I think one of the first jungle drum and bass tracks to hit the top 40.
In the charts. I'm glad you tell me this, because my reaction to it was... Is it where the phrase the jungle is massive came from?
Yeah. There was probably already a kind of underground jungle scene happening in London, but this was the first commercial breakthrough of that into the charts. With regards to pop culture, and this was probably one of the first jungle tracks that people would have heard.
Which is cool. But I just sort of, that phrase got said a lot, didn't it, between kids at school and stuff. It just became a verbal meme of its time. So... Yeah, no, I enjoyed hearing that. It was fun to hear
it
that.
It was good, and it was good.
What number?
That got to number 8.
Fantastic.
Which is brilliant. And
well done,
and
Britain.
Well, sometimes we get it right. And it's easy to forget, actually, how in the later part of the 90s, jungle became a bit of a kind of, not a joke, but, you've got Ali G and you've got the way that Sacha Baron Cohen...
Too much parody around it, you're right.
You know, that kind of thing. Whereas you go back to then and you had that, you had people like Goldie, you had Ronnie Size, you know, there was a lot of real kind of strong jungle drum and bass. So, but number 8, well done to MBeat featuring General Levy. Where'd you put Shampoo in Trouble?
You know what? I sort of nearly wrote about it because it is really 90s, this song.
Yeah.
It is kind of pop-tastic. It's kind of a hybrid of sort of Spice Girls and I mentioned Biss briefly, didn't I? But that kind of like cheeky, sort of saccharine punk pop. So I do like it. And I think it's a sort of track that with a certain audience, you could DJ it and people would really enjoy it again. Yeah.
I got lost in a rabbit hole with this track. I started finding so much stuff. So Carrie Askew and Jackie Blake were Shampoo. They were on Food Records. So straight away, right?
Famous Blur.
They were fanzine writers for the Manics, right? And appeared in the video for Little Baby Nothing, which I didn't know. So it was
is ringing distant bells, damn it. Right. This is great intel. So
their first single was called Blisters and Bruises and was co-written by Lawrence from Felt.
Felt, right.
That was released on Ice Rink Records, which was Bob Stanley and Pete Wegg's record label.
Well, I have learned so many things that I absolutely should know already there. Thank you very much for your TED Talk, Ian.
I'm available for hire for TED Talks on Shampoo. As you mentioned, though, this is 2 years before the Spice Girls. But, you know, you can see the genesis of that coming through what they're doing here.
It's great, actually, to hear its little sort of the sort of roots of it. I mean, what I do remember is that they were either, maybe via the Manics thing, there was a Shampoo fanzine that people speak of lovingly, don't they? It's a kind of cult thing.
Yeah.
But were,
yeah.
were they maybe writing it, or were they just being featured in it? I can't remember, but I know there's a sort of fanzine culture around.
So the fanzine was called Last Exit, and they were part of the writers for
that. That's right. Maybe they were sort of like the Spice, the sort of KLF-y type Spice. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kind of like,
yeah.
They were knowingly working with the sort of pop industry to sort of subvert it. And, you know, I'm sure there are people listening screaming at their phone or podcast player because they're like, yes, of course they were doing that.
Yeah.
And Last Exit, I know, is sort of famous in cult sort of fanzine chat. Yeah, I mean, but they didn't do other things, though, did they? I don't remember other things
not
beyond
really.
The song.
In July 96, just a week before the Spice Girls debuted with Wannabe, they put out a single called Girl Power.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God, they had some premonition of the Spice Girls.
Which made number 42.
That's really mad.
And the B-side of that was Cars by Gary Numan, and that is worth hearing. But it's almost like the time was just wrong.
So we talked about Stuart McConey, obviously famously coining Britpop, but did Shampoo coin Girl Power then?
Well, that is that huge big rabbit hole. There are people would say that actually Shampoo were at the genesis point of identifying the whole concept of Girl Power. Now, I'm sure there's probably other people would claim that as well.
That is great. I can thoroughly understand the rabbit hole that you've been down. I think you need to get back down there.
It's good fun. for my soon-to-be-published BBC4 documentary on Shampoo. And the 23rd best song of 1994, according to NME.
Well, actually, with all of that backstory, I agree.
So let's stay on Food Records. See what I did there. That wasn't bad.
I see what you did.
Park Life by Blur.
Yes, and another small band at the margins of 90s culture.
Small. Blur. I'm just looking on the sleeve of Now 29. They've got a capital B on there for Blur.
Oh, that's a shame, isn't it? We need a nice loopy, curved letters.
Should be, to be honest.
It's weird to see this tucked away on the final side, isn't it? But yeah, it was put there to make sure the likes of me in the sixth form common room actually turned it over.
Best British single of the year. Best British video of the year. At the 95 Brit Awards. Was that the one when everybody was behaving really badly? Or was that 96 ones? I can't remember.
That was all of the 90s, wasn't it? I can remember Damon waltzing on stage, swaggering up there, and they won four that night, didn't they? Can't argue with Park Life. Really can't.
Big enough to be performed at the Olympics in 2012.
I was at that gig, and I've got sad news, because I obviously wanted to enjoy Blur on, you know, in the middle of the Olympics. It was a really beautiful hot night and everything, but were you there?
No, gosh, no, I had been.
Okay. I'm talking about the gig they did in Hyde Park.
Oh, the Hyde Park gig. I think you meant the closing ceremony of the Olympics.
During the Olympics, but it was called, there was a sort of, I don't know, they kind of billed it as Best of British type thing, which probably is a bit cringe in retrospect, but it seemed good at the time, and they had like a Royal Britannia-y image that Blur had on their artwork.
Yeah.
Anyway, the problem was, I think there was some of those local restrictions around noise, so you could not hear Blur. So I was middle crowd. Like, I've been to see Blur enough times to know that you can hear them in the middle, but you couldn't hear them. So loads of people like me just sort of wandered off because you couldn't hear Blur. And it was like, this is the Olympics. And you could go off and watch stuff on other screens instead.
Yeah.
So for the one and only time in my Blur viewing life, I wandered off. Mid-gig.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
I think I came back for, like, you know, to see the encore when obviously Park Life would have been played, but sadly, you couldn't hear them. Unless it was some freakish wind direction situation that I didn't understand. But no, couldn't hear them. Sorry, Damon and Cole. But seen them about 25 other times, and they were excellent all the other times.
Every time I've seen Blur, they've been amazing. I lost a watch during Tea in the Park. Blur set in 1994. I came out.
Were you crowd surfing?
No, I was just trying to keep on my feet, basically. But at some point, I came out and I'd lost a watch. So, Damon, if you're listening, I'll have a watch, please.
Yeah.
I guess it was probably a bit of a kind of defining moment for Phil Daniels as well. I mean, you know, you talk about Quadrophenia and things like that, but, you know, most people now would probably just think of him and that video. And
it's such a good video. And I remember finding the exact. I can't remember the brand, but the zip top, the tracksuit top Damon's wearing, which is navy blue with cream collars with a little green line down. It's really nice, actually. I remember finding that top in, like, an Oxfam and being just so happy. And it was in my size, and it having, like, the... I don't know where it is now, but the Damon Park Life zip top was just, like, the finest charity shop find I ever had. Is this track the most synonymous with 1994 track on Now 29?
I would say so. Yeah. Mm. I would say so. That or Ultimate Chaos. I can't decide. No.
That's why it's weird that it's down in the final little countdown, yeah.
As now progressed into 95 and 96, the tracks started to shift up the way. If you go to now 30, now 31, for example, you're starting to see tracks like Common People and All Right by Supergrass and Wake Up Boo and all of those tracks and Roll With It and Country House. They were much higher up the track list. But then where would it sit? This is the point.
Mm.
Where would you... Because if you shifted that up to next to Big Mountain... The whole album starts to kind of fall off its axis a bit. So,
it's a really good question, actually. Where would I put it if I could put it somewhere else? I just don't. Maybe just in the middle somewhere. When we've come down from the high of Sophie B. Hawkins.
Yeah, it would sit more comfortably amongst. Well, obviously you've got Oasis.
It shouldn't be next to Oasis, though, should it? Because that's too obvious. Maybe do you know what? I know what we absolutely need to do. Robert Palmer can go to side four.
Yeah.
And Parklife can come in and be before REM. And then you've got Blur, REM, Oasis in a row.
Isn't it great recreating now history? But yeah, you know, you're right. Because actually, Robert Palmer.
Off you go.
Well, do you know what? He would probably be more comfortable rubbing shoulders with Erasure, Sparks.
But we do need to get onto those two.
Because they're
kind of cool then, knocking around.
I love Saturday because it's something you don't hear by Erasure very often.
Mm. I actually love Erasure, and it's very rare that they don't create an amazing melody.
Yeah.
I'm glad to see them here.
And that album, the I Say album, that's on there, always is on there as well. It's a great album. And that was produced by Martin Ware from Heaven 17. Sparks.
Sparks are on an Now album?
This, sadly, to date, is the only time Sparks have been on an album because they didn't really feature in the charts very much.
No.
Sadly. And, you know, you think of those great run of tracks in the 70s and stuff like that. They've appeared on other Now albums like Now Glam Rock and Now 70s and things like that. But with regards to the famous numbered series, first one, but actually fair play to Now Team, brilliant.
Really fair play because I absolutely wouldn't have known who Sparks were at the time in 94. No. I've only retrospectively understood their place in sort of pop history and how they're like, they've got all these albums, a huge prolific back catalogue, but actually only a cult fandom. And it's weird because I'm sure it's been said 100 times before, but they are basically the kind of the Pet Shop Boys in terms of their big, amazing, pop-tastic sound, but with a hint of knowing kind of cheek as well. They know what they're up to. And of course, that documentary is a great watch.
Brilliant. It's fabulous. You know,
I really love this track, but no way evokes 1994. And we're not saying the title, are we? But When Do I Get to Sing My Way? So the title itself is kind of postmodern, isn't it? it's brilliant,
It's just from the album, gratuitous sax and senseless violins. I mean, that in itself.
Other people that know way more about Sparks will have said all this before, but they're sort of the Gilbert and George of pop music, aren't they?
Yeah.
Has that been said loads?
No, but I think we should start saying it now, Anna,
Let's
to
say
be
it
honest.
Now.
Because I was writing down, you know, this I suppose at the time would have been seen as some sort of comeback for Sparks. It was their first top 40 hit since Beat the Clock in 1979.
Oh, wow. Which, probably is the most famous song, isn't it? Probably.
Yeah.
Easily recalled.
Between then and that would have been a 15-year gap. But they never went away. I mean, if you go back, like you know, you mentioned in that film, you know, they were making music all the way through the 80s and 90s and continue to do so.
I wish we could end there. That would be the perfect last track, wouldn't it?
And do you know what, folks? Let's just... That's how the wonderful Now 29 finishes, but it doesn't. Because we have I Want the World by the horrifically awkward spelling Two-Thirds. With
it's
a number
awful.
Two,
like
number
a,
two at
it's
the beginning.
It's like a password.
It's like, that's what it is, actually.
Number two, W-O, then T-H-I-R-D, number three. It's basically two-factor authentication from 1994.
So the song is called I Want the World by Two Thirds. Now, they were managed by Tom Watkins, who managed E17. They had toured with E17. Yeah.
Did they flop? Because I just don't remember them.
Well... No, they weren't huge, but there's a bit of a legacy if we're going to finish the album on anything, because one of the members of the band was a man called Richard Biff Stannard. And Biff Stannard then went on to become one of the biggest songwriters of the 90s because he wrote songs like Wannabe. And
oh my goodness.
Wrote for Five. If you've read Michael Cragg's wonderful book about the 90s,
Reach Biff for the Stannard's Stars.
In hundreds of the chapters. So it's the beginning, it's a false start, shall we say, for Biff Stannard, who then went on to become a writer and wrote for Little Mix and Kylie and Spice Girls and Five, etc, etc.
He Look was in Biff the Stannard. Band, or he wrote their songs?
He was in the band. He was the background boy type stuff. And
it's
and
not
yeah,
as
and
good a rabbit hole as the shampoo one.
It's much shallower. It's a much rabbit hole,
it's just
to be
a
honest.
Small little kind of mole hole that you've dipped into.
It's a little mole, yeah. But it's of note for that it was, you know.
It is really of note, and I suppose that's the beauty of kind of, we're talking about music being in layers, and that's a perfect example of it, you know.
Yeah.
A false start actually is in its sense, in its own way, a kind of little clue as to what happens next.
And that then does bring the end of Now 29 for us. If you could select a handful, just a small rabbit-sized handful.
Right, I'm going to have... Oh, it's quite hard, actually. I'm going to take with me... I can't not take Bloor Park Life, because that is synonymous with 1994 and the beginning of everything, really, and beginning of, personally for me, a huge love affair with Bloor. But I'm also going to take with me... because we've talked about her a fair bit, but Sophie B. Hawkins, Right Beside You,
mm-hmm.
just as a beautiful slice of pop music that I could hear any time, it would make me happy. A third one. I mean, you didn't restrict me to... Oh, Confide in Me, Kylie.
If you can hold two in each hand, you can have four. But not.
Okay, I'm going to have four. You did say. So yeah. What else do I want? So Kylie's coming. And actually, do you know what? Oh, God, it's quite hard, actually. I think I might take Trouble by Shampoo just because of the magical connections yeah. that you've just revealed. And I sort of remember now, like, that they had the fanzine and the slightly weird Mannix connection. But
yeah.
the fact that they have invented girl power, I think I need to
I think we need to start the campaign, I think, to be honest. How much of a time capsule is this then for you for 1994?
It is pretty good, actually. And for that reason that we talked about, which is that the things that we like to draw memories from, and I do a lot, you know, loads of music has massive sort of memory trigger for me, and everybody I know is the same with music. But actually the weird tracks that we talked about, the tracks that are kind of, I've only heard the last time in the 90s. So some of those more handbaggy house ones, Corona, The Real McCoy, you know, they are actually how the 90s felt at the time. And they have a place, and they kind of paint the gaps between all the sort of more cartoonish things and the Union Jacky things that unfortunately we can remember more, or that have been, I guess, featured in all the kind of, you know, listicle shows on TV and stuff. So yeah, no, it was great. It's really fun to go back through it. And even though there are complete weird dead ends in there as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, really fun and good to remember. And actually a final word for Lisa Loeb, because that is a tune.
Go back and listen to Lisa Loeb, people. And just be careful, because Ethan Hawke might be hanging around outside the door. Anna, thank you so much for joining us and revisit Now 29. I think you've enjoyed that.
I really did, Ian. Thank you so much for taking me by the hand and down all those rabbit holes. It's been an absolute joy.
Thank you very much.